if I can, and to tell you men, and then we'll talk about this separately tomorrow, what I think you owe to your wife. And then tell you wives what you owe to your husband. And then to tell both what we owe to our children. So that's our outline here. I was in a barber shop one day and picked up a magazine, and the front cover was gone and the back was gone, so I don't know the name of the magazine. And something caught my eye that I still have, and I tore it off of the back page and kept it with me. I still have it in my file. I think I have it memorized. I don't know if this was a part of a story, but it was very obvious from the part I read that a newly married couple was having trouble. And the older husband, was counseling the husband in one room, and the older wife was counseling the younger wife in another room. And so what I was reading there was the dialogues that had taken place. And so the opening part of the dialogue, as the older husband was talking to the younger husband, was, he said, "She wanted to be told that you loved her." And so the younger husband said, "But I was shaving." And the older husband said, "I don't care what you're doing. When a woman wants to be told that you love her, if you have the IQ of a moron, you will do it." Then he went on to explain. And I'm not sure that I agree with this fully, or whether psychologically it's sound or not, but it illustrates the point we want to bring out. He said, we live in a big world, and woman is a very tiny creature in part of it. And it's her nature to be a little bit afraid and insecure with the bigness of it all. And he said, the only thing that cures that is one day a man comes along, he falls in love with her, and she becomes the most important person in his life and his world. So she's arrived. All of her heart hopes and expectations have been fulfilled. It's too good to be true, and she just can't believe it. And so because that it's so great and wonderful, and she wants it to last, she's suspicious of any little evidence that maybe this isn't true after all. And so she needs constant reassurance that she is the most important person in this man's life still. I tested this one day with a couple who had been married for a week. They were here. He and I were talking, and I said, has she asked you yet if you still love her? And he looked at me. He didn't realize anybody had been eavesdropping. And he said, how did you know? Not even a week. Well, this is what the older husband was telling the younger husband. You owe her the security of love, of knowing that she is still the most important person in your life. And men, they need reassurance by word and action. So we go back to the statement I quoted. He said, when a woman wants this security, this reassurance, if you have the IQ of a moron, you just forget about what you're doing and take care of it. So, what do you owe your wife? The constant security of this knowledge of love and that she is important. Now, some of these others I'm just going to pass over briefly because of a lack of time. You owe her the security of leadership. Ephesians 5:23. Brings out that as Christ is the head over man, you are the head over woman. And 1 Corinthians 11:3 through 5 brings out the same thing. I'm just going to hit two or three points in the outline and that I have here, and I'm going to dwell on two or three points at length. You owe her the security of consideration. And I want to read 1 Peter 3:7 from the Amplified New Testament. The security of leadership, which I wish we had time to discuss, but I think the others are more important. 1 Peter 3:7 in the Amplified, in the same way, you married men should live considerately with your wives, with an intelligent recognition of the marriage relation, honoring the woman as physically the weaker, but realizing that you are joint heirs of the grace of God's unmerited favor of life, in order that your prayers may not be hindered and cut off. Otherwise, you cannot pray effectively. But the security of consideration. Now, I'm going on to the next one here because it deserves more time. The security of communication. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul had been dealing with a subject, something that had come up that, in his estimation, had caused a little disorder in the church. And so he devotes this 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians to this. And then after he got all through, he says, "For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace," in verse 33. And then I think Paul, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, had had something he wanted to get off his chest for some time. And this just seemed to be the place to fit it in. So he tacked it on here. And he said, "Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church." Strong language. Now, I heard Dr. Jim Graham commenting on this once. He said, here's what he thought the background of this was. In many parts of the world, in fact, most parts of the world where you travel, you will find that there are certain churches, church auditoriums as you go in, and there's a six-foot solid wall right down the center of the church. And as the people come into the church, the women file in on one side and the men on the other. And the women can't see the men can't see the women. The person up on the platform is the only one who can see both of them. Now, in a situation like this, even today, but much more so on the day this was written, the men would file into the church, sit down very reverently on their side, perhaps pray or meditate on Scripture, get ready for the service. They had seen each other every day during the week in the course of their business. We're all caught up on current events and gossip and so forth, ready to worship. But the woman came in on this side and probably hadn't seen one another since last Sunday. And they noticed that one's missing. "Well, now, where do you suppose she is today?" "Oh, well, hadn't you heard that she broke her ankle?" "Oh, no, well, I hadn't heard that. Well, who's taking care of the children?" And so pretty soon, it gets a little louder, and a little louder. And so the men over on this side that are trying to meditate and be a little spiritual and worship are kind of upset by what's going on. And the pastor up here trying to start the service, he doesn't know what to do to get this shut off down here. So they laid down the rule. Let the woman keep silence when they come to church. And he said, if they want to know what the latest is in current events and gossip and so forth, let them ask their husband at home. He knows all of this. So as far back as New Testament times, wives had difficulty with their husbands telling him what was going on. They just didn't communicate. And so the only way they could get caught up was to find out from one another. So husbands, we owe the wife the security of communicating what's going on so that she's a real partner in the family. And this is a constant problem, isn't it? But this is one of the things that we owe, and it isn't a new problem. Now, I know there's another verse over in Timothy that deals with this same subject, but I feel here in 1 Corinthians 14, this is purely a practical matter that Paul is talking about. Let's have the service orderly. If it isn't, it's the husband's fault, because he doesn't tell his wife what's going on, and she has to find out from somebody else. Now, just one other thought here. Over in Proverbs, the last chapter, on the godly woman, speaks about her children and her husband. And the verse I'm looking for here is 31:28. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Well, this is easy to do the first few years, isn't it? But later on, easier to complain than it is to praise. My wife tells me that she works cheaper with a little bit of praise thrown in. She works harder also. But isn't it easy to neglect us? But the scripture says that, as it's speaking primarily of the godly woman, that her husband praises her. This is a duty and a responsibility. Now, to go on, and I'm just kind of laying this out like a classroom, aren't I? So since we are, and we're a small group, now why don't we just have a discussion here? So if you have something you want to say or disagree with or agree with, well, just go right ahead and we'll keep it informal. At least five things that the husband owes his wife. Now we're just going to talk about one that the wife owes the husband. And I'm back again to my barbershop back page. The older woman talking to the younger woman. And she was telling her that she had a little responsibility in this too. She said, you know, a man is kind of an odd creature. He believes that he's kind of the Lord and Master of all creation. And anything he can think of, he can do. Just turn him loose. Give him a lever and a place to put it, and he'll lift the world. This is his whole attitude and outlook. But she said, all day long, he is in a competitive atmosphere. And there are people who are competitors who are sort of beating him down to his right size. So often, when he comes home at night, even though he has this world-conquering complex, that his ego has been deflated just a little bit when he walks in the door. And so there's just one place left where he can be the Lord and Master, and that's his own home. She said, now, if you join in on what the world's been doing to him all day, why, you're going to irritate an already bad situation. So just let him be kind of the Lord and Master and the big shot around the home, because that's probably the only place that he will ever realize this ambition that he has. Well, I think that was good advice, that the older wife gave the younger wife. But scripturally, in 1 Peter 3:2, we have these words in the Amplified New Testament. I begin in the middle of a thought here, but I'll go ahead anyway. When they observe the pure and modest way in which you conduct yourselves, together with your reverence for your husband, that is, you are to feel for him all that reverence includes, to respect, defer to, revere him. Revere means to honor, esteem, appreciate, prize, and in the human sense, adore him. And adore means to admire, praise, be devoted to, deeply love, and enjoy your husband. Ephesians 5:33 has an even longer list than this. We have somebody walking out here on us. However, let each man of you, without exception, love his wife as being, in a sense, his own self. And let the wife see that she respects and reverences her husband, that she notices him, regards him, honors him, prefers him, venerates and esteems him, and that she defers to him, praises him, and loves and admires him exceedingly. Now, you ladies can see why I only said there's one point I'm going to bring out here. And that was Ephesians 5:33 in the Amplified New Testament. Well, what do the parents owe the children? Several things. We can comment very rapidly. The security of love. We know that this covers about every other deficiency. But on a more practical way, the security of discipline. The children need to know where they stand by consistent discipline when it's needed, which does not necessarily depend on how you as a parent feel. You probably saw the cartoon that came out several years ago in which the little child was asking his father. He said, "Why is it that when mommy gets tired, I have to take a nap?" The actions and reactions of our children affect us different according to the state of our health and the condition of our nerves, do they not? But a child doesn't always understand this. Discipline needs to be consistent, not on how we feel. In 1 Samuel 3:13, concerning the sons of Eli, God says, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not." Eli didn't discipline his sons. Now, there's a very important point here that I hope we'll be able to get hold of. Back to Proverbs again, which has a lot of good information on child raising. In 2:26, we have the command, "Train up a child in the way in which he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." I've had a new insight into that verse here recently, and that is, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he was old, he will not depart from it. The indication seems to be that there'll be some difficulty in keeping him on the straight and narrow during the younger days. This is a foregone conclusion of Scripture. It's when he's a little older that he'll fully realize the value of this. In Proverbs 22:15, it says, "Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him." In Proverbs 19, 18. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. And in 23:13, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. But they develop pretty early a way of making us think that they're being killed. But no matter how much he yells, he says he won't die. Now here's the important part, 14. Thou shalt beat him with the rod, and shall deliver his soul from hell. The preparation of a child submitting his or her will to Jesus Christ is a submission of his or her will to you. So discipline is very important because it prepares the child for salvation. In our connection with servicemen, we have many parents write, and they're really concerned about the condition of their child out in service, what he's done. Well, I've asked a few of them about the home life and find out that the parent let the child have his own way, grew up and got in service, never submitted his will to the parents. There's not any preparation, much preparation for presenting Jesus Christ to this person. Because if he hasn't submitted his will to his parents, he's not prepared to submit to Jesus Christ. So when you discipline a child to where that his will is submissive to yours, as I said earlier, he's being prepared for salvation and to submit his will to Christ. We don't want to overlook this important teaching. Just a comment from Genesis 18:19. We owe the children the opportunity of development. Over here, God said to Abraham, "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." I know Abraham. I know what he's going to do for his children and his household. And that's the reason he could trust him with greater things. However, I think the greatest thing that we owe to our children, and I believe is the area of probably my greatest failure, is example. And I think whenever I bring this up of Genesis 22, Abraham and Isaac, as they went up to Mount Moriah. At this time, Abraham was more than 100 years old, and Isaac was someplace between 18 and 30. He wasn't some little innocent lad that didn't know what was going on, but he was a grown man, probably physically superior to his father. I have a 19-year-old that I sure wouldn't tangle with. And I have a 16-year-old that's about able to get the better of me. And I'm not quite 100, almost. But Abraham had passed 100. So you remember that they left the procession and went up the mountain. And Isaac had seen his father do this quite a bit before. And he kind of questioned this, particularly when he built the fire. And then Isaac said, "Now, where's the lamb? Where's the sacrifice?" So Abraham said, "Well, the Lord's going to provide one." And he said, "If you just lay down here, Isaac, I'd like to bind your hands and feet and get close to the altar here so that after I get your feet and hands tied, that I can kind of ease you up on it." Well, Isaac wasn't naive enough to not kind of see through this. Particularly after he got his hands and feet bound, they took out his knife. What was going on in Isaac's mind? He asked the question, where is the offering coming from? And Abraham said, son, God will provide an offering. Abraham's testimony with his son Isaac was such that he had never doubted a word that he had said about what God would do. So I think that he wasn't even nervous as he was there, because he had seen his father's words come true so many times that he knew they would again, and he wasn't worried. I think that my spiritual example and teaching does not have that influence over my children. I tell them, oh yes, God will do this, God will do that for them. But on the basis of what they've seen in me, they don't have a whole lot of evidence to back it up. We owe them the power of example, because this will affect them more than anything else. And as we've made some analyses of children out of Christian homes, many of them who have failed, and we've tried to find out why. Now, this seems contradictory to what I said before, but very, very frequent, it's been because of a spiritual defect in that home relationship between the parents. For example, some busy day, you see a car drive up in front of your house, and you recognize who it is in the car. And you say, I wonder if she's going to stop in here. Well, she's heading this way, she must. Well, of all the inconsiderate things to do, to come at a time without this, without phoning, she knows that I'm busy, and take about 2 or 3 minutes just to kind of give her a little character analysis. And then about that time, she gets up the door. And you say, oh, it was so thoughtful of you to come over. I'm so glad to see you. Won't you come in? Well, I hope it isn't inconvenient. Oh, no, it couldn't be inconvenient. You couldn't have come at a better time. So over here in another part of the house is 5 or 6 year old or a little older, trying to put this situation together. There is only one conclusion to which that child can come, and that is that mom or dad is a hypocrite, and a mighty big one at that. And they form their basis for their theology not so much on what they're taught in Sunday school or what we teach them at the family altar, but it's by observation and example that their theology is formed. So we owe them a good example and an authoritative example. Now, one more thought, we're through here. Dr. Edmund of Wheaton College has written a book on revival. And in one of the chapters, he quotes from Charles G. Finney, in which Finney has asked the question, when does a revival come? And Finney answers the question by saying, when two or more people get right with each other and with God, then revival comes. It'll break out. No matter what part of the world this happens to happen, two people get right with each other and with God. Who are the two people who, then more than any others, should be right with one another? It's a husband and wife. Now, I don't say that this is a logical conclusion to draw, but if it were, we could ask the question, at whose doorstep do we lay the blame for the lack of revival in the world today? We lay it squarely at the door of the couple who are not right with each other and then with God. So there are great things at stake in our family relationships. And I know Pastor Ortland said that on the last night, the conference, he's going to have a wedding ceremony, a post-rehearsal, I guess you'd call it, or something like that, in which you go through the vows again. Well, as I say, there's more involved than just our own enjoyment. There are great spiritual issues at stake in us being right with one another and then right with God. That hand, it's got about a minute to go before it's 12:30. I think somebody raised a hand maybe to catch a reference here or something back here that I didn't respond. Do you have some question or comment you want to make here? This is a discussion here. Okay. Well, tomorrow will be split sessions. And husbands, I don't know what I'm going to cover because I've covered all I know and quite a few things that I don't know.